All right, hello, welcome to the At YouTube Podcast, where we talk all things YouTube, album news, tour dates, community discussions from the staff of At YouTube. We are back once again to continue our series on album by album series of YouTube albums. I guess, obviously, I'm joined once again by Sherry. Hello, Sherry.
Hey, I wish this podcast hadn't been recorded in the back garden.
Kenny, do you have a rattle and hum quip at the ready?
Oh, no, I haven't. Oh, no, I wasn't expecting that.
Well, it's okay. We can almost... I can't. I'm not prepared. There we are.
Sort of a musical journey, really.
I was going to say that, and I thought, oh, no, I'm going to steal Larry's thunder.
We can sub in some for you. Aaron Govern is back as well, or Ivan.
Hi. Hi, everybody.
How are you, Aaron?
Now, I'm very good. Now, thinking what you're just saying there, perhaps what you can do for me is to make me look like Montgomery Clift, particularly as this is a podcast, nobody can see me.
Have you got... Sometimes you drop references that are too obscure for me, even me.
They're even obscure for me.
Imagine what Montgomery must think.
So
I don't think he looks good now. That's
for sure. Okay, moving on.
We're all a bit punchy because some of us were up a little late last night. That's okay.
Yeah, and some of us are up late as it is right now for Aaron and Kenny across the pond. But we're all home, depending on when you're listening to this, actually when it goes out live or goes out to you in the podcast feed. We're recording it live. It's probably going to be released in a week or two. Who knows how this whole schedule works. But we are all back and safe and sound from the YouTube 40 weekends that happened what feels like a long time ago now. But it was actually only, as we record this, just under 2 weeks ago, I guess. And so Sherry and myself were in Cleveland. Aaron and Kenny were in Dublin. I'd love to hear Kenny and Aaron just some thoughts on how Dublin went down and what your experience was there celebrating U2's 40th. Kenny, you go first. Put you on the spot.
Crikey, I was going to say, I'll start off with Guinness. No, do you know what? It was a fantastic weekend. Bumped into lots of U2 fans from all over the world. Hats off to Aaron, he did a fantastic job. It was magic seeing Ivan McCormack there, and he just totally got right into the spirit of things. I think he quite enjoyed his moment in the spotlight, so to speak. December,
40 years in the making.
Yeah, I know, absolutely. But he was great, and he just totally got into the interview thing on stage, and some great stories. And actually, everyone just stopped and listened, which was fantastic. Bearing in mind, it was a kind of great wee venue and, you know, potentially quite chatty, but everyone listened in. And great bands. December were absolutely fantastic, so they were. A fantastic version of I Fall Down. I think it's splattered all over YouTube and whatever else, but if you haven't heard it, go and check it out. Really, really good. And then the Joshua Tree, my first time ever seeing a tribute band, and they were fantastic. So it was a great weekend all round, actually, so it was. Met lots of people that I've seen online or new online and all that kind of sort of stuff. Great buzz about the place, great badges. I don't know what else to say. It was fantastic. Oh, and the Guinness was quite good as well.
I think you mentioned that already. No, <I'm just> kidding. Yeah, what was that like? I guess you said this. I'm just curious because you said this is your first time seeing a U2 cover band, and it is kind of a weird experience for fans to sort of like see a band copying their favorite thing. And some of us have had the opportunity to see that, you know, in multiple times maybe or whatever. But being that this is your first time seeing it, what was it kind of like? Was it a bit odd to sort of...
Visually, obviously, it's a bit odd because you don't have Bono, Edge, Larry and Adam right in front of you.
Right.
But, you know, in terms of... I thought they sounded really good and, you know, pretty similar to the real thing. I mean, I probably shouldn't really say that. But, you know... And really great sound. They were loud. Everyone got into it. So it was kind of quite surreal, actually. But, it just really worked. Would I rush back and see another tribute band? I'm not sure I would. I haven't really thought about it. But it was... we saw... there was another tribute band we happened to see in another venue, which were okay as well. So... I suppose I actually have seen two, actually, when it comes to think of it. But it was great. It was great. Very surreal, as you say, but actually probably less surreal because Edge. I can't remember his real name. Actually, really sounded like Edge, so he did.
Yeah, it's like, it's a little funny when you're saying it, referring to the person impersonating Edge or something. But Aaron, you had a big hand, obviously, in organizing, and kudos to you for putting in a ton of work, getting that all set up and organized, and keeping everybody on track and all that kind of stuff. At least from what we observed across the pond, anyways. But how does it feel to be done now? And any sort of reflections on the weekend?
Oh, it was just superb. And myself and my family over on the Thursday, so we made a bit of a mini holiday. All my folk live in Dublin, in any case. But it was great. The Friday night, as Kenny mentioned, in fact, I met Kenny quite late on in the church, which is a pub club in Dublin, to see another tribute band, and they were fantastic. And of course, we also had Googie there that night. He turned up, and that was great for the U2 fans, many of course who had never met him before. Quite a character. And that was great. And as I say, the whole thing worked very, very well. We had a very good venue in the Grand Social. The Joshua Tree, absolutely ultra professional outfit. And I mean, it's a bit of an insult almost to call them a tribute band, because they are as good as U2 in terms of musical capability, and the renditions of some of the songs, in my my view, they were even better than the real thing, excuse the pun. And there were songs that they, you know, we had the vote online to pick a few of the rarities, but also as well they pulled out some nice songs to hear live, like Exit. You would never normally expect to hear a band play Exit, but it was absolutely brilliant. And I've only ever heard Exit on the Joshua Tree tour, so that was great to hear it again. And I think for me what was fantastic was just watching the faces of best over 350 people, I think we had, Kenny. Just watching the sheer unadulterous joy in their faces throughout the whole of the concert. It really actually felt like being at a U2 concert. And big shout as well to December, who were mesmerizing. They were just absolutely superb. And I would recommend everybody to go out and check them out. Buy their album. It's available on iTunes. Really are a superb band in their own right. And I say, Ivor McCormack, now our friend, he himself is also a very, very good musician. And his stories were just brilliant. We had lunch with him earlier on the Saturday, and just the stories about the music industry and, you know, the parallel careers of his own band with his brother Neil. As U2 got bigger and bigger, it was very funny to listen to him, and he's just naturally a good, fun all-around guy. Really, really good. But I say we were very pleased, because I say it was very well received. We had people from, I think it was 16 countries. We had people from Brazil, Australia. We had them from Canada, America, everywhere in Europe you can name. And, of course, even Ireland.
Even Ireland, wow.
Even Ireland.
I'm curious now, you mentioned Canada, who came from Canada, but I don't expect you have kept a roster of nationalities and who came from where.
Well, amongst others, we had Aaron Sams from U2 Songs, U2 Wanderer, and he had brought over a fair few people from Canada. Well, not him personally had brought them over. They had their own flights and stayed in separate hotels, I believe. But no, there was a lot of people. And, you know, a big shout out as well to U2 Fan Tours, which is a page, Facebook group on Facebook, obviously, called Phil Chambers, who lives in Nottingham in the UK. He had more or less brought over about 100 people. And then we had 160-odd people come from United Kingdom. And he alone had brought over around 100. And that was great to see so many people. And we had a lot of people who'd been on the U2 I&E live video in Paris. There's quite a few of the ladies who'd been up on stage. So they were there. So it was a good, all-round fun concert.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And the amazing thing is that event sold out in like less than a week, didn't it, when tickets went on sale?
I think we did it in 4 days. And you know, there was at one point in time we were thinking, crikey, should we move it up to 500, 600, 700? And I think we could have sold it out, but that's what made it extra special, I think, was the fact that everybody knew it was a very hard concert to get in. We had a lot of people gatecrashing on the night as well, trying to get in, trying to buy tickets. So they were a bit like gold dust. in the end. So that was a good vibe on the night. It really helped.
Nice. Yeah, it's awesome. And over here on the other side of the pond, we had obviously the Cleveland, I was going to say Cleveland contingent, but obviously folks from around the world came to Cleveland as well, to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame to help celebrate as well the U2 40th weekend. If you are listening to the podcast, episode number 40 was the conversation we recorded from Cleveland with Dave Fanning. So by now you've probably heard that, but that was, I don't know, Sherry, if a brief recap of any other, like there's lots of stuff there, obviously, just sort of that was awesome to see, meeting the folks, for me anyways, meeting a lot of folks for the first time, meeting lots of you listeners out there for the first time. And having that opportunity to see folks in person, like the folks from the U2 project, obviously lots of folks from the U2 team, Kelly Eddington's artwork that she's done, seeing that. It's one thing to see it on the web, but seeing it in person and seeing just the detail and how good the photos, the artwork looks, was awesome. And of course, chatting with Dave Fanning was great. Anything else, Sherry, from your side of things?
It was a whirlwind. I unfortunately had to leave very early on the Sunday morning, so I kind of missed Mr. Gatecrasher there.
Oh yeah, of course, there's the other.
Suddenly showing up on the monitor during one of the sessions, but you know, Adam can do whatever the hell he wants. He's welcome anytime. But yeah, it was fantastic to be at the Rock Hall because of the history that was there. And I think that this is going to lead beautifully into our Rattle and Hum discussion in a few minutes, because in order to understand U2, you have to understand all of the influences, and they were all there, you know, so you could go over to the punk section and look at some of the artifacts from Patti Smith. You could see the stuff from television and you know, all the punk influences. And you could go over to, you know, just a few steps away to the rhythm and blues influences and you know, find out stuff about B.B. King and so on and so forth. So it was a fantastic location in order to fully appreciate the 40 years of artistry that this band has presented to us. And then to have that married with the rock power politics exhibit that they had there about the political protest and how music has been at the heart of that for over 60 years, and the amount of influence that a band like U2 has had over the span of four decades and continues to, you know, that was a nice addition to the whole weekend. We had hundreds of people come out. It was fantastic to see everybody, and I was so grateful for the people like Fabiano who yeah. came to Cleveland, and we had people come in from all over North America, South America. I think we had a couple from Australia. We certainly had a few from Ireland and from England in as well. It was just a fantastic weekend. But I do have to say, having a sidebar conversation with Dave Fanning, who believes that our work on At U2 is a paid profession, and having to tell him, no, we do it out of love in a volunteer way. We don't get paid for what we do. We just do it out of passion for the band, the fans, and the message, and to have them go, well, bloody hell. Yes, that's how we feel too, Dave.
Yeah, that's, I don't know what Aaron and Kenny, you guys experienced, but there, I overheard and had conversations with a few different folks, just like sort of amazed that finding out that this isn't like a paid gig. And even friends back home who saw me going to Cleveland thinking, wow, that's great, you got podcasting, you're being paid to go to Cleveland to interview, you know, these U2 people or whatever. And like, no, this is just for fun. This is out of pocket. This is not a, yeah. So not that we don't say that because we're, you know, worried that you're thinking anything other than that about us, but just because folks sometimes wonder and think that we're getting a lot of money out of this or something like that. But it is all in fun. And even the thing with Adam Clayton, like many folks sort of expressed surprise and wonder that that happened, and we were as surprised and in wonder as well. It was obviously I didn't get to be there, and like Sherry said, she wasn't there, so it's not something we knew about even beforehand, because I was sitting in the airport and saw a notification that this was happening and going down. So there's lots of folks who were out of the loop and by necessity, obviously, and I guess. And so just it was great, though, to have that. And we will be posting. We've got video from the Rock Hall. We've got audio that'll probably be put into a podcast episodes to be heard. You've no doubt if you're a hardcore fan at all, you've probably already watched a few different versions of it that were posted and recorded by folks who were there. But I'll put a link to the YouTube page where we've got Adam Clayton's interview with Dave Fanning, which, like Matt McGee said, was the best interview ever, I think, of one of the band members.
Fanning can get away with asking Clayton about having a brown pant moment.
Yeah.
None of us could ever have the balls to ask him that. So,
well, maybe now we'll ask him about wee stinking on the nettles or something. Aaron, what was the?
Oh, yes.
No.
Yeah, no, I can't say it.
Yeah.
There may be children listening.
Right. All right. Okay. Well, that's enough of a recap. We've talked about a bunch of the site, and I'm sure it'll be referenced in future episodes as we do this, but thank you all again for coming. Thanks to all the folks who helped organize and put the both events together. And here's looking forward to, what, the 50th? We'll see if the band and all of us make it to the 50th. We'll be celebrating again somewhere. So
I plan on it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's get into the album that we want to discuss this episode. This is the first podcast episode you're tuning into. We've been going album by album, song by song through U2's albums. Started with episode number 34. If you go back to goodstuff.fm/ATU2/34, that's where you'll start with Boy. This episode, we're talking Rattle and Hum, came out in 1988, right? That's a long time ago. It feels like it was yesterday. And of course, there's the film Rattle and Hum, and then the album Rattle and Hum. And by coincidence, or something like that, we happened to actually get to watch Rattle and Hum in the theater in Cleveland. We booked the theater, and a bunch of folks who were there for the conference, obviously, got to come and sort of hang out and watch the movie. And I don't know about you, Sherry, but it was just, I had never seen it in the theater, first of all, and I've never been in a theater with a theater full of U2 fans watching a U2 concert rockumentary, whatever you want to call it. And that was just like a fun experience that I highly recommend to anybody if they get the chance to do, just to try and do it, because you have people singing along to the songs, of course, people laughing at the things that you laugh at maybe when you're sitting at home watching it by yourself, and crying at the appropriate moments to cry or whatever, and holding up their cell phones as lighters during, which was it, With or Without You probably. Anyways, just a fun experience that kind of like leads us nicely into this discussion of Rattle and Hum, but we'll be focusing mainly on the album and less on the movie, but it's worth a rewatch if it has been a while, like it had been for me. So for you guys, where and when, how did you come across Rattle and Hum? I know, Sherry, I think you had mentioned that this is kind of like your album. So we'll save you for the last, maybe. We'll go, Kenny, what do you remember of hearing Rattle and Hum when it came out, or what, even just before it came out? What was sort of the word on your street?
Yeah, I obviously this was kind of like we'd moved on from Joshua Tree, and this was kind of obviously them capturing that kind of phase. And I remember not being cute. I can't remember too much about being aware about the build up to it, other than I knew it was kind of kicking around. But I remember when it came out, and I was walking in Union Street in Glasgow, where there was two record shops. It was HMV and Virgin, which that's when they sold proper records, like vinyl type things. And walking past the window display, and there was a massive window display of the album cover. And that's the one thing I always remember about this album was seeing. Because I think it's a fantastic album cover. I love the kind of whole spotlight thing, because Bono did that quite a lot during the early days as well. We used to pick up the spotlight and shine it across the crowd, and I always thought it was really quite effective. So it was part of that kind of, you know, next phase of Joshua Tree. I remember scratching my head thinking, wow, they've gone on to doing a movie here. This feels like really huge, and I probably wasn't quite sure about that. But I also remember thinking, this is great because I get to see more of the band, because obviously in those days, you know, you didn't really have internet and all that kind of sort of stuff. And actually, as an aside, I do remember going to see, I saw the film twice in, I know we're not talking about the film, but I saw the film twice, sorry, and both times, the first time I saw it, I went with my sister. There was maybe about half a dozen people in the cinema. And then the second time I went to see it, I went with a friend from university, and it was just the two of us in this massive theatre in Glasgow. It was an afternoon showing, and we had the entire cinema to ourselves and that big screen. It was fantastic.
Nice.
So, that's my memories of it. But but particularly I love the album cover. I thought that's when it always sticks with me. I remember seeing that, thinking, "Whoa, I love that."
Yeah, yeah. The hosts are under threat of talking about the film is why Kenny really snuck out. I'm just kidding. Aaron, how about you? What do you remember when the album dropped?
Yeah, I remember it very well, actually. I mean, similar to Kenny, I was at university. I was in Birmingham in central England, and I queued up at midnight on HMV on New Street in Birmingham, main shopping district. And it was the first album by U2 that really had a worldwide, almost multimedia star release. I mean, obviously, I realise we're not talking about the film, but the film did come out several weeks afterwards. It's about 2.5-3 weeks afterwards. But this was the first U2 album that actually had the tape, the cassette, the LP, and the CD all released on the same day. And this is obviously when the CDs were really just breaking out, because even the Joshua Tree, the CD, wasn't out on the first day. It was several weeks after the album had been released. So this was a big, big event. And, you know, T-shirts were available on day one, all different types of things. So this is really seeing U2 at this point now. They'd already obviously done the Joshua Tree tour. They'd already now become massive in America, massive worldwide. They're on the front cover of Time magazine. And they were now in a different place. They were stars. You wouldn't really even need to describe U2's at the edge. It would be just at the edge. You would need the bit of the U2 there. And, you know, they were now so big that they had become real rock stars. But the thing about this album that's quite different to every other album they've done is, of course, we've got this mixture of live recordings, covers, and new songs. So it's a bit of a strange album to go back to now, 28 years now since it's been released. It's one that I listen to a lot, but it is an album that perhaps has become a little bit unloved, a little bit like October in that respect. And as time has gone on, and obviously the band have recorded different albums and different releases, it has a different feel to it, this album now, with the benefit of hindsight. And I think it's sometimes unfairly regarded by critics, even U2 fans, as they were being a very pretentious, very presumptuous, a bit arrogant about how they were going about their business, particularly with the recordings and Sun Studio. You know, they always had explained that they had no influences in their musical career, and I think that was correct. And then there was this homage to the days of rock and roll when they go back to the Sun Studio. So I think there was a little bit of a backfire and a bit of a media backlash at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sherry, how about you? Was it when the album came out that you were drawn to it, or was it sort of post-release that you stumbled?
Believe it or not, I wasn't drawn to it because it was U2. I was drawn to it because there was only one copy of it left in a Crazy Eddie's record store in New York City. I was in the city on a field trip with my Latin class, of all things, where all I can remember is semper ubi sub ubi, which means always wear underwear. But that's, you know, 4 years of Latin for you. But there was only one copy of the cassette left, and there were two people arguing over it. So I'm like, ha ha ha, I'll go and buy it, then they'll be arguing over nothing. So it wasn't for any other reason than to shut up two people who were arguing in the middle of a record store that they were arguing over nothing. And then I decided, well, what the heck, I've got a 3.5-hour long bus ride back to home, I'll listen to it. And I was immediately suckered in. It was like a hit of some narcotic, and I was hooked from the very beginning. And at the end of my first listen to it, I wanted more. And so, you know, they would be talking about the Joshua Tree. So, well, let's go out and get that album and see what that's all about. And within about a week, I had consumed a lot of U2 music in a very short period of time and just fell head over heels in love with them. I couldn't understand why there was all this backlash about the band and all this other stuff. Because for me, it was just about the music. This was December of 88 when I purchased it. So the album had already come and gone as far as all the publicity goes for it. The movie in the United States was only in movie theaters for like 36 hours because the ticket sales were so abysmal that Paramount pulled it very quickly. So I never got to see it on the big screen. The whole reason why I was in New York in the first place was because of personal reasons, which I wrote about in an at U2 article, which we'll link to. Mm-hmm. But you know, there's just so much for me that brings me back to that December 15th, 1988 day. I remember it like it was, you know, just yesterday. Even, you know, the smell from the German Konditorei next door, I remember every single piece of it. So for me, Rattle and Hum will always be that album that nobody can deny me. So for all of the songs, it was the first time that I had heard them. You know, I remember watching U2 on Live Aid. I remember watching them in 86 when local TV stations were broadcasting the last Conspiracy of Hope tour. But, you know, that was just background music. I really wasn't paying attention at the time. I was totally into like Duran Duran and that type of thing. And I just wasn't attuned to them. And then, you know, upon first listen, that was it. Hawk Moon was the final hook, and that was only the fourth song in. So I just knew at that point.
Yeah, didn't take long to get you hooked, for them to get their hooks in you, I guess. Or
oh yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting one too for me because it's the last as frequent if you've listened to the other episodes and heard me blather on about albums. I came at it from Acting Baby, and so I was working my way back. And friends had this playing, and it was kind of like Aaron said earlier. It was this weird, like I was thinking Acting Baby was U2, this industrial, you know, heavily distorted, etc., rock outfit, and then the next album I was hearing them play a lot was Rattle and Hum, and it's kind of this weird juxtaposition of these two bands that almost sound like completely different bands, and understandably so, you know, knowing now in hindsight what the history was, that they're where they were at. But I had no idea, no way of knowing all the mythology and news that was going on with the band at the time, just hearing the music and stuff in a friend's basement, and being instantly attracted to the music. It was it felt raw and authentic and honest, but then also this kind of weird, like, why do they have Helter Skelter sort of included? Like, I mean, it's the full song, but it sort of sounds kind of weird. And then going into a studio track, and then, like Aaron said, kind of just back and forth. It was kind of a weird album, but I knew I was drawn to the band in terms of hearing. I've always been drawn to music, especially once I've heard it live, a band, hearing them live. That's when it really sort of draws me in, if they can replicate the energy of whatever's on the record or CD or MP3 into a live setting. And then I'll go back and consume all the rest of their stuff. And that's definitely what Rattle and Hum kind of helped me do. So, and I'm impressed now looking back too, just how prolific the band was during this period of recording material, like covers. And obviously there's a bit of like I think Aaron or Kenny had mentioned, you know, sort of trying to find influences in a way, and that pushed them into recording a lot of different covers and the B-sides and stuff that sort of found their way through the next few albums, even that they all recorded or started recording during this time. You certainly don't, as Dave Fanning put to Adam, you know, with the gap between recordings and stuff, they don't seem to be quite as prolific these days in terms of hungry to record music that gets out there anyways that they put out, sticking to the albums mainly. But I digress. We'll moving on, we want to go a bit, we're not going to go exactly song by song, just because a lot of the songs are obviously versions of music that's already been on previous albums, and we're going to try and sort of skip around a little bit with that. Yeah, before we do it, Kenny, you had mentioned the artwork being sort of a thing that really drew you in. And I just learned something when I was doing a bit of research that is probably common knowledge to some YouTube fans, but wasn't to me, is that it is actually just a reenactment, you know, a photographic studio or whatever, a reenactment of what they were doing on stage. It wasn't actually from a live concert experience that they had that photo or whatever, which makes sense. I mean, it is a really good version of of Bono with the spotlight and Edge perfectly sort of positioned, etc. And probably not as sweaty as they should be given what we saw with Rattle and Hum. That's what I was impressed with, how or weirded out by how sweaty the band was on stage, particularly Bono. But I digress. We'll save the film version for another episode. So the album itself, just in terms of reception and release, it hit number one in the U.S. album charts, remaining at the top spot for about 6 weeks. So it was one of the top selling albums in the U.K. that hit number one, double albums anyways that hit number one.
Yeah, a couple of other facts about that, actually.
Sure.
Just going back to the album cover, as you said, it was a studio reenactment. It's also the only album cover by on a U2 album that's not been designed by Steve Averill or Sean McGrath. So this is the only time they've not used the traditional Dublin company. I don't know why that ever happened, but that's the only time.
That was probably because of Paramount Pictures.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, because it was all pretty much wrapped up, the production, post-production, everything was done in LA, wasn't it? Ocean Way in Los Angeles, I think, and A&M Studios. So a lot of that got presumably contractually changed. And as you say, the album sold fantastically. I mean, it did 14 million worldwide. In the UK, it held the record for the fastest selling album for several years. I think it was Oasis, and Be Here Now was the next the next album that held that record. So they held that record for a long, long time in terms of fastest selling album. So lots of things about Rattle and Hum that were unique for U2 at one point in time. You know,
Yeah, much like you said, Aaron, it's kind of a bit of an album of contradictions in a way, where it has been and was kind of derided a bit as like this pompous, you know, arrogant kind of thing for them to put out. But then obviously the fans loved the music and it sold really well, but it's this weird kind of collection of music to put together and doesn't strike you in hindsight as with looking at their whole catalog. Is it a bit of an oddball in terms of them putting this out at the time and stuff like that? But yeah.
Well, whatever we say about Rattle and Hum and even non-U2 fans, the one thing that's great about Rattle and Hum, without it, Acton Baby wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, it's very likely true. Like, they wouldn't have been in that place where they felt like they needed to, I won't try and do my Irish accent, but go back and dream it all up again, as they say. So,
yep.
Moving on to the song. So, I'm trying to think the best way to do this without being here for 3 hours. Not that that would be a terrible thing, but supper and bedtime does... I mean, we need to do a little bit of trimming, but I'll play a little bit of each song as we go through, just so that people have a reference point for where we are, because I know that helps me anyways with these kind of discussions. But the album opens obviously with Helter Skelter. Which is U2 covering a Beatles song, and is powerful when you see the movie coming back to the album that way. It feels an odd opening to my senses anyways, but I want to jump right ahead to Van Diemen's Land, because I know there's a couple folks who want to touch on this one. And I, in listening to it again, I feel like it's one of the more beautiful U2 songs, actually, that they've ever recorded. But I know, Aaron, you had some comment on it you wanted to make.
Yeah, Van Diemen's Land. I mean, to say it's really just Edge and his guitar. It's written by Edge, I think, alone. And to say it's a beautiful lyric. And, you know, I remember going to see U2 on the Lovetown tour. And okay, that was virtually 15 months after the album came out. But Edge played that song that night, I think on every night, if I remember right. And it's not very often you get to see Edge just sing on his own, just with his own accompaniment. But it is a beautiful, beautiful song. And isn't it written about a Fenian poet, if I remember right? I haven't got the liner notes in front of me, but I'm sure it's John something. I can't remember who it is now. Hold on. I have the album behind me.
John Boyle O'Reilly, I think.
That's the fella. Yeah, he's an Irish Fenian poet.
He was deported to Australia because of his poetry.
Mm, a rebel.
Yeah, it wasn't very good, is what we're isn't there? Bono quote from that. And Sherry, did you have a story about this too?
Yeah, I was at the Zoo TV show in Boston on St. Patrick's Day, and got to be there for the first ever U.S. performance of the song live. And it came as a complete shock because obviously nobody was expecting it. But to be in Boston with so many Irish immigrants, having, you know, on St. Patrick's Day, having Edge perform it and knowing what the history was, there really wasn't a dry eye in the house while Edge was over on the B stage.
Nice. Yeah, it would be a very I can't see them pulling it out again. Who knows? They never say never, obviously, but it's one of those rarities now to have be sung. So next track is Desire. And for me, this is one of those songs that instantly drew me to the band because it was aggressive, that sort of famous Bo Diddley beat or whatever, but like a lot of the tom-tom use by Larry and then lyrically just dead on, awesome, deep, but easily attainable, catchy lyrics that sort of drew you in, and definitely one of those songs that drew me to the band musically as well as lyrically. And obviously it has been used right up to this day, you know, as recent as whatever it was a few weeks ago when they used it to point out some issues with Donald Trump, maybe. But
lest we forget.
The candidate.
The candidate. Unless we forget also a great Bono solo on the harmonica at the end.
Right. Yeah, which would be the first, was that the first, public anyways, recorded harmonica solo of... And last, maybe, by Bono. Kenny, did you have something else for Desire that you were...
Yeah, no, I mean, there's two things that always draw me. I mean, I think it's a great song, and I remember hearing it for the first time, and it was kind of different, even actually, if you want, from the whole kind of Joshua Tree bit. I love the bit at the beginning when he goes, yeah, and then it kind of just sucks you into the rest of the song, so that's always a wee bit of a standout moment for me, which is really quite sad. But the other big kind of shout out, I think, on this, and I'm going back to album covers or going to covers, is the actual cover of the single for Desire, which is a picture of Larry drumming. And I think it's one of the most coolest covers that they've ever done.
Yeah, I remember.
And they just kind of caught it. It's kind of black and white, as that whole kind of gig was. But, you know, I just think it looks really cool.
Yeah, I remember playing the Hollywood remix of this tons in my basement, just like I'm sure my parents got sick of me playing it over and over. And then also the B-side on one of the singles anyways was the Hallelujah, Here She Comes.
Yeah.
And learning that on guitar, because I always turn to Rattle and Hum, a guitar nerd moment here, but just because it's such a good one. If you have an acoustic guitar, U2 songs aren't all, there's like, I'll say this with it, but anyways, there's not a ton of them that are accessible on acoustic unless you sort of rework them or whatever. But whereas Rattle and Hum is full of acoustic songs that are easy just to bash out on an acoustic if that's all you have and you're not sitting there with your delay pedal and your effects rack to play along with Edge, as the case may be. So,
as a sophomore in high school, I had to look up what Voodoo Economics was thanks to the Desire 12-inch single.
There you go.
Probably
yeah, right.
Tonight, due to economics.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. There, it's learning economics.
A great song, a great single, and 3 minutes of pure joy again by U2.
Yeah,
one of the great 3 minute singles they've done.
All right, Hawk Moon next.
Yeah, this was the final straw for me, as I mentioned earlier. See, I was in the city because my grandfather had told me, no matter what happens, go on your Latin field trip. Now, he was very ill for quite a while, and that was one of the last things that he ever said to me. And the day of his funeral was the day of the trip. So, looking back on it now, 28 years later, it's as if he was trying to, you know, he had a premonition, or, you know, he was trying to sway me in a particular direction. And so I look back on that one trip and seeing how my life has completely changed. So as I'm listening to Hawk Moon, you know, with my headphones on this dark bus driving back to Connecticut, all I could feel was the sadness in my heart, because we were burying him that day, and I just wanted his love. I wanted him back. And so over time, this particular song has, you know, meant different things, but at the core of it is that core desire of just wanting to feel loved, and no matter what, just feeling it. Bono had said in Hot Press about Y269, he said, we actually physically wore out the tape doing that many mixes, you know. So I can't even imagine if it would have been Hawk Moon 267 how much different it would have sounded, but it's a very personal song for me.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those ones that can mean many things to many different people and different, like you said, even at different times of life.
And the drumming, yeah. That I cannot think of a better song to highlight how important Larry is to this band than Hawk Moon 269.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And is it Muzzle of a Gun? Is that the lyric, or is it?
It is.
Okay. Just checking. Sounds, you can hear different things different times. That lyric can be different things to different people all on its own, I think. But that's a very cool story, Sherry. Thanks for sharing. And then it jumps into All Along the Watchtower. Which is, to me, is always a funny one that they include it, because that you can, I don't know, the band goes at it hardcore and they definitely perform the song with a lot of enthusiasm, not necessarily the best example of a good U2 cover, I guess, in terms of musicianship, but they definitely go at it and go fierce with it. It's from the San Francisco concert that they did, obviously live.
Embarcadero Plaza. Yeah. But wasn't it also included because of the ode to Bob Dylan, and then Dylan ends up later on the album as well?
Yeah, it seems like that would be a good connection. And then Hendrix is on it in terms of the Star Spangled Banner, and he famously sort of made the song even more famous with his cover of it.
Right.
So
it's a cover of a cover.
Yeah. So, which, and then the, you know, in the movie, obviously we'll sidetrack a little bit, but they're sort of luring the song as they go out on stage. So commend them.
And by the way, the movie is off because he did not spray Rock and Roll Stops the Traffic during Along the Watchtower.
Right. It's because that was actually during Pride or something, right? I think is what the, yeah. So they took some creative license with the arrangement of things. That's never happened before with a U2 video. No,
never.
And then we'll go into, or goes into, I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For. Which I'm sure, like, the song itself aside, obviously we've talked a bit about on Joshua Tree, the Joshua Tree episode, but I think you have to have a certain I don't know, element of your soul lacking if you can't enjoy this live version, or especially hearing it this way for the first time. But I don't know what you guys, Kenny and Aaron, if you have thoughts from when you... Well, was it?
It's certainly a gospel song in this live version, because we have this beautiful choir. Is it the New Voices of Freedom?
Yep, under the directorship of Dennis Bell.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And in fact, they had a bit of a career going on for themselves straight after they had released quite a few different versions of this on single themselves. But it's a beautiful version, and probably still my favorite live version of I Still Haven't Found, you know, that's been released by U2. Beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah, I always think that's probably how they really would have loved that song to be recorded, because it is very much a gospel song, and I think they managed to hit the mark on that. And I think they also, I'm pretty sure they used the choir in, was it a couple or at least one of the live concerts as well. It was one of the ones that Bono was wandering around with his arm in a sling.
Right. Yeah,
which would have been good to hear as well, actually.
The album version is Madison Square Gardens.
That's right, that's right.
And the hum on the film was when they went into the church to meet them for the first time, effectively.
Yeah.
And we have an article on the site, an interview with Dennis Bell, Rattle and Hum at 25, that Matt did back in 2013, and we'll put that into the show notes.
Oh, nice, yeah. There's actually quite a few articles on this little At U2 site you guys have done over the years. It's awesome discovering a treasure trove of stuff here. It's almost like it's a musical journey. Okay, moving on to...
Oh.
That was what watching... We can't not do it. Watching the movie and forgetting just how kind of home video cheesy stuff some of the moments were. And I felt bad in like an awkward way for the band sometimes, that they were like put in front of the cameras and clearly didn't know what they were going to be doing in front of the cameras. Because I've done that to my friends many times too. All right, Freedom From My People. Oh, apparently I did a really short clip of that one, I guess. But it was hearing this one on the album was just kind of like, I don't know what you guys pictured when you heard it. It wasn't exactly, I hadn't seen the movie. And so I didn't have any idea where it was or what it was. It just kind of, I thought it was like a sample from something that happened like a really long time ago, and not like, obviously once you see the movie, you can see that, Bono and I think Gavin Friday and a few other folks are sort of wandering the streets of New York and come across these guys. But yeah.
And that was Sterling McGee, Bobby Robinson, and Makel Mabins. Published by Bobby Robinson, Sweet Soul.
Nice, yeah.
Publishing.
So yeah, it was just again a funny but interesting kind of. Obviously, heading into this sort of next set of songs that they were doing, Silver and Gold, Bride, Lover, etc. You know, thematically it fits, but again, just like including another artist's sort of song on one of their albums is kind of a weird thing, I guess, in this day and age for you and two. But all right, let's keep moving. Silver and Gold. All right, anybody have some... my only comment on this one, I love the song, but having seen the movie again lately, I can just see the Edge and Adam... sort of their awkward dancing as they play this song is kind of burned into my brain a little bit too much, I think. But I don't know. Kenny, do you have a Silver and Gold thought?
I actually quite like this because this was the full band version of the song that Bono wrote for... Oh, crikey, somebody help me out.
Artists United Against Apartheid.
Oh, that's right, yeah, which was really... That's right.
That's right. It was effectively a hidden track, wasn't it, on the Sun City album? Yeah. It wasn't even listed, so right at the end. It was the one they did with Ron Wood. Oh, sorry, Bono did, I should say, not you two. Bono did with Ron Wood and Richard.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was, yeah, and it was real rough and ready when he recorded it, which actually sounds great when he does it on his own, so he does. But, I mean, the full band version really brings it alive. And, I mean, I think actually this recording of it does it real justice in terms of it being a great song. But I do like the Bono kind of version of it, but there's something just, well, it's the same, isn't it? When you bring the four of them together and they kind of play music, it kind of makes things happen. And I think this is a kind of really good example of it. They do. So I think it really does it justice. It really makes the song come alive.
All right. And next up is Pride.
I know why I don't like Pride Live.
You figured it out?
Because I was weaned on the Rattle and Hum version, which has got a much faster tempo and it's much more upbeat. And when they play it, it's been at a slower tempo and in a different key, and it never sounds the same.
Yeah, which is actually, like, it may sound silly that to, like, as if you're being really picky, but it often is just like a subtle change in key and or tempo that can completely change a song, which is, again, going back to when a band decides to record a song and they do set a tempo or they set a key for a song. You know, you can freely move it up or down key or tempo, but it does affect the energy and the vibe of the song, to butcher that phrase. But I can totally agree with you, and especially, again, like seeing the concert video, there is just a, feels like a bit more energy in the song that isn't there the same way, or I've just heard it tons, I guess, is another way of looking at it for myself. But that's a good observation for sure. So,
and I also like how they, in the olden days with an A side, B side, C side, and D side with this particular release, Pride ended the first side of the cassette. So when you flip it over to the next side, you've got what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 new songs all in an order. So it's like Pride is the last of all the, you know, the greatest hits types of live versions until you get towards the end of side two or side D or whatever format you're listening to it on.
Yeah, which is a thing that you don't have to think about as much anymore, but definitely would have been part of the process, intentionality of song placement on the album, for sure.
Talking of which, it's have you ever done the thing where, I mean, I confess to doing this, where you would have the CD and you'd put it on cassette but take the live tracks out? You ever listen to Rattle and Hum like that? It sounds strange. It doesn't flow.
Interesting. I can't say I've ever tried
that. I've never done that.
Yeah, I have.
Have to make a playlist now of that. Yeah.
Yeah, of course, you could easily do it with Spotify, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That's cool. That's a good idea. But obviously, you're saying it's not worth doing, so maybe we will.
Well, it just doesn't work.
All right, let's keep it moving. Angel of Harlem. And that's one thing, just listening to that little clip even there, there's a certain, and I noticed this when I remember saying to Sula or something, when we were watching the film, that there's a certain Bono voice that he doesn't really do anymore. And there's kind of that voice in that song almost is that version of his voice or those notes or whatever that he's hitting is something that isn't there as much anymore in his current sort of repertoire. It's different, you know, his voice is aged, obviously, just like he is.
He kind of sounds like a giddy little schoolboy getting to record in Sun's studio.
Yeah.
There's like a happy quality about it, which you very rarely ever get.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And it's a live recording or live band recording anyways, I'm sure. And, so it'd be, could be part of that.
I think, Angel of Harlem, I mean, this is the first of the three songs, isn't it, now, where the studio is Sun Studios, but they recorded a lot extra as well. I think they had done Dancing Barefoot, they'd done Fortunate Son, Everlasting Love, Unchained Melody. So they obviously had a fantastic time at Sun Studios, because obviously only three tracks made it on the album, but they used it to record a whole host of B-sides and cover versions as well. that really was a unique opportunity.
Yeah, which going back to your suggestion of taking out the live tracks, is maybe a better version would be like, because those, a lot of those ended up on B-sides and things and are worth tracking down if you've never listened, but like putting those back in as sort of a rattle and hum with the B-sides and no live tracks or something might make for an interesting playlist that you could go through too. So yeah, let's keep moving on to Love Rescue Me. Which is the one of the tracks that it features, obviously, another artist. Bob Dylan is in the background there playing and sort of mumbling along a little bit, I think. But Sherry, you wanted to get a comment on this one?
Yeah, you know, going back to first hearing it, as if I wasn't already, you know, in tears by the time I finished with Hawkmoon. I got to this and it just ripped my heart out of my chest. I think I was a little young to really understand the heavy lyrics, like a particular blues man told Bono about the next song that we're going to talk about. But I liked the back and forth between what Dylan sang and what Bono sang, it's a song that has grown on me over time. I really appreciated the version that the band did during the Smile Jamaica benefit in 1988 with, I think it was Ziggy Marley. But this is a song that needs to come back into the set list.
No, all I was going to say was I think it's an interesting song. And so I would agree it should come back into the set list. And I think for me, and I know we all joke about the musical journey thing, but that's exactly what this album's about. And actually, you know, it's a wee bit like the Joshua Tree set lists were a bit like that. They were a wee bit kind of all over the place. There's a mixture of cover versions in there, and because Borilka's goes kind of country on this one, for me it just kind of sums up the fact that we're just trying a bit of everything out. And I think that was lost in quite a lot of people, either in terms of the movie or perhaps even the record itself. But for me, this is the one that always just kind of reminds me of why that album is that album, if that makes, I don't know if that makes any sense, but that perfectly, it's a great song, and Bob Dylan's on it. But I just think it kind of sums up what the album's all about.
And it's got a lovely gentle intro and a lovely gentle outro. And in between, you've got this soaring Bono vocal.
Yeah.
It's, again, another great song. And I love the way you just described that. It is you two doing country. But you're bound to when you've got Bob Dylan in the corner of the studio. Who wouldn't?
But it's also a song that never made it in the film.
That's true.
Yeah, that's true. What I remember watching again this time is why, if you have Bob Dylan there somewhere, you'd think they'd put him on film. And maybe there was, I don't know, would it be a rights thing? Or I don't know. Or just they didn't have the cameras there that day for some reason.
But on the... on the album, you know, this is buried as a track to begin with. But I would have thought if you've got an album and it's a double album of 17 songs promoting a movie, all those songs should be in the movie in the same way as just about all the songs in the movie should be on the album. And that's not the case.
Yeah.
So that really struck me. Why wasn't this in the movie?
I think, Sherry, perhaps what happened, Dylan set definitely wouldn't have been in Sun Studio. So I think this is probably the one track which is probably a bit of liberty. I'm not so sure they definitely did record this in Sun Studio.
Yeah,
I think it's the credit has been Sun Studio, but logically Dylan would have been in LA or somewhere else like that.
Yeah, and the other one that didn't make it in was God Part Two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit of a weird on the promotional side. Let me say that again. I can't imagine what some of the discussions were between the movie folks and the music folks trying to figure out, you know, what's going to go on where and why, and U2's reasoning for not and wanting certain things and all that kind of stuff. So someday we'll read the behind the scenes expose when Edge decides to write it down or something. All right, When Love Comes to Town. Maybe I was wrong to ever let you down, but I did what I did before So I love this track, not just because of B.B. King, but there's the lyric, the depth of the lyric, obviously, and it's covered well in the film, but just as a fun U2 track that Larry gets to play a fun beat on, and then Edge's solo next to B.B. King is kind of the most edgy thing to do, of just like playing three notes over and over again while B.B. King is there playing 16.
B.B. King is horrible with chords.
I know.
So Edge had to play all the chords.
But his, yeah, for his solo, he just like goes, anyways, either he was really intimidated or he just stuck to what he knew, and that's the way it went. But Sherry, did you have some
thoughts? I love the 12-inch remix on this one.
I'm trying to remember.
That if you get the 12-inch single for it, it had the big blues female backing vocals with the hey, 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 although it sounded much better sung by the professional. And it's just fun. It's a deep track. You got to find it if you don't have it. But if you're a fan of the song, you've got to find that remix. It's fantastic.
How about over on Across the Pond, was sort of this bluesy U2 received well by you gents?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was fascinated with B.B. King at around the time anyhow, so it came as a big surprise to me that even recorded anything. Because you didn't find anything about the album till you picked it up and had it in your hands. There's no internet at all. And I was fortunate, as may I mention earlier, to see the Lovetown tour. So B.B. King U2 each night, and you know, imagine B.B. King supporting U2. It doesn't quite sound right, does it? But and also, you know, so he did his full show, and then of course they came back and they played these three songs each night, if I remember right: Angel of Harlem, Love Comes to Town, and Love Rescue Me. And I remember B.B. King singing Love Rescue Me as well with Bono on stage, so that was quite unique. And you know, a fair play to U2 to make such a big thing. I'm making sure B.B. King and the whole of the band, it wasn't just B.B. King, the whole of the band, B.B. King's band, came up on stage as well to play with U2. And they did that night after night, all the way through Europe, for sure. I'm not sure if they did it in Australia. I think they did.
Yeah.
But that was their love and respect for the guy.
And what was nice, too, was that I saw B.B. mid-90s, and he started an encore with When Love Comes to Town. Mm. So you know, it was a song that Bono gave to B.B. and he ran with it. So I was quite pleased that he would add it to his repertoire, given the depth of the music that he did over the 70 years, 80 years that he was making music. I thought that was a nice bit of respect there.
Yeah, and it's a testament to his longevity, because like that was in 88 or 87, depending on when exactly it was recorded. But and then he still continued playing and lived up until 2015. So, and I remember like watching the movie again. He seems like a pretty old dude there, and then he continues playing for almost another, help me with my math here, 20, 30, 30 years, right?
It was such a gut-wrenching thing leaving the opening night show in Vancouver last year for the Innocence and Experience tour and seeing the news that B.B. had died, and knowing that we were going to get When Love Comes to Town for night two in Vancouver, which we obviously did, but the sad reason why we were going to have that be part of the set list. B.B. was the same age as Bono's dad, and I'm sure that there was some sort of adoptive father-son relationship that Bono and B.B. had dating back to this particular collaboration.
Yeah, Fabiano in the chat rooms mentioned that B.B. King always played that song in his concerts in Rio, three times he saw him there. So very cool. Obviously, it's not just a thing for U2 fans. Obviously, the B.B. King fan, or B.B. King himself anyways, at least, was a huge fan of the song. So I have to imagine this Heartline is one of those songs that for people who don't like U2 or Bono, it's like one of those over emotive kind of songs they point to, or at least would have, you know, back in the day anyways, as a song they didn't necessarily like. But I find it, I love the song. It's one I can, it's like a empty, sparse kind of song, but then has this great Bono vocal on it. What do you guys think of the of Heartland? Where does it register with you guys?
It's one of these ones that falls, I think it's a bit of a fan favourite, I think, actually. It's a wee bit like Acrobat. It's kind of one of those ones that you hear people saying, oh, I'd love to either hear that. I love it. I think it's so atmospheric. I don't know if it's a Hangover. I can't remember if it was a Hangover from
I think it's Joshua Tree.
Aren't the credits to Lenoir and Lillywhite? Not Lillywhite, Eno. It's certainly Lenoir anyway, yeah. And the lyrics are fantastic, yeah. Mississippi in the cotton wool heat. It's magic, absolute magic. But I'm pretty sure it is one of those kind of ones that, you know, whenever you ever see fan polls kicking around about.
Ironic you mentioned that. In a 2014 Rolling Stone poll, it ranked number 6 on their readers poll of the top 10 best U2 deep cuts.
Right.
Yeah, I'm looking at the same article. So it's definitely a song that it's funny that the poll is a little suspect that Bad is the number one deep cut when it's played fairly regularly, but anyways, that's not ours to bicker with, I guess. But
it feels like to me it's been recorded in the swamp. That's what I love about it. So you can definitely tell it Lanwell's been at it.
I wasn't sure if you're gonna say that was a good thing or not, but there.
No, I wasn't sure what you're gonna say there either.
I just want to know what Edge found over the lift there, Edge. They never answered that in the movie.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
One hidden, wait for the DVD extras, Blu-ray something extras, whatever, whenever they're
released. Found your lyrics to October, Bono. Yeah.
All right, next up is God Part 2.
This was the song that basically pointed the way to Achtung Baby, I think. Now I think it was propaganda or something that I remember reading an interview and they kind of called it out and said this is basically a bit of a taster of where they were going directionally. It's a cracking song, very, very different sounding from the entire album. So it does, we talked about the fact it didn't make it into the movie, it does kind of sit there a wee bit like a sore thumb because the rest of it's all kind of reflective of musical heritage, whereas I suppose this song kind of, I don't know, maybe I'm, I suppose it is a more industrial, which is where they were kind of going, you know, but I suppose it was new in terms of concept, or certainly my concept of what music was all about. I think it's a great track, and I never got to see it live. I know Aaron did, and he'll probably talk about that, but it sounded great, fantastic.
Yeah, it was paying homage to John Lennon and his song God from the Plastic Ono Band album. So it was like Bono picking up the where Lennon left off with it.
And Aaron, you got to hear it live?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I mean, I still say this is easily my favorite song on Rattlin' Hum, one of my very favorite U2 songs. It's an absolute hidden gem, I think. And like Sherry says, you know, I just love the aspect of it being God Part 2. As I say, if you ever listen to God by John Lennon, I don't believe in Zimmerman, I don't believe in Beatles, you know, it's great lyrics by Lennon. And, you know, we have here now, I don't believe in Goldman being American biographer of many different books by usually dead musical artists such as Lennon and Elvis, I believe. And the whole song is just such a departure from the rest of Rattlin' Hum. It's a real dark sound, and definitely it's almost as if it was recorded and on the wrong album. You know, it should have been perhaps on that Acton Baby. It is that different. The rest of Rattlin' Hum is very much a homage, very much more blues, country, folk type of songs all together. They fit in well. Not that this sits like a sore thumb or anything, but it's to me, it fits on the album very, very well. Going back to it being one of my favourite live songs, because I always remember Boxing Day 1989 and the anticipation of you two coming up on stage at the Point Theatre, which is tiny then. It wasn't an arena, it was just a small theatre with 4,000 people, and the lights went down and you just heard this big thumping bass drum of Larry's and straight into the song, and Bono was menacing that night, and this song was just fantastic. And that's my everlasting memory of you two that night, was watching Bono on the riser jumping up on the drums, and just great.
Yeah, definitely as that live, like especially as an opening track, which you wouldn't necessarily have thought of it as being, but I can totally see that like theatrically or whatever. It's a great one to play off of. It sounds to me like, not to go too long on God Part 2, but like it's a bit, you guys mentioned sort of the way forward to Ak Tung, but it also, maybe this is why it wasn't kept around or whatever, but it has a bit, to me, it's always had a bit of an 80s vibe, sort of pop rock vibe to it with the process sort of dance almost drums. But I know it does kind of mix in with Ak Tung where they were headed there too. So It's interesting.
Oh, we have a mention tonight actually as well. You know, Jimmy, I always say Iovine, but it's not as is. Jimmy Jovine, is that how you say it?
No,
I can pronounce it. Is it Iovine or?
Yeah.
I don't know. I've always pronounced it that way. And obviously he's gone on to various different aspects of his career. But of course, you've got to remember, Jimmy, he recorded Lennon. So he had that advantage of you too. And you can imagine tales being told in the studio between him and Bono. You can just imagine sharing that information.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, we'll include it just for completion's sake, but Star Spangled Banner is next. Which, of course, leads us right into Bullet the Blue Sky. Which, again, we did discuss Joshua Tree. It's worth mentioning, of course, a really good live version of the song. Includes, obviously, a fairly... I was going to say good. I don't know if good is the right word, but a good Bono rant directed at the events of the day, bombings in Ireland at the time. It was, again, hearing a live version of a track like this that you would have heard on Joshua Tree, I don't know, for Kenny or Aaron, what was your sort of impression of it? And is there, like, the politics of it was, I guess, timely discussion relative to what U2's been doing now again in politics, and you sort of hear people saying, like, why doesn't U2 just stick to music? They shouldn't be involved in politics or whatever. But in the day when you sort of, back in the day when you remember hearing this track for the first time and the references to what was going on, how was that received, and what did you think back then, Kenny? If you remember.
I know, I was going to say, do I remember? I think at that stage I was still just so blown away by the sound of the song that, I mean, the linkage is obviously with the political aspect of it, and it's evolved so much over the years. In fact, actually, I saw Matt tweeting about it from the show that we're not supposed to mention because that's in a couple of weeks' time. you know, just how they've kind of evolved that song and how they use that song is actually really, really quite powerful. And I think it's actually the structure of the song, the drums, the wail of the guitar kind of fits in with that kind of whole protest piece. I think, though, my recollection of the time was just simply being quite still engrossed in how that song sounds. You know, it sounds fantastic on the Joshua Tree album itself, which we talked about before. And then this was it kind of breaking out into that kind of live arena. And it's another one that it kind of cranks up a notch or two or three, just sounds even more powerful than the album version, which I think is really hard because I think the album version is pretty bang on. So, you know, I'm not sure I'm necessarily right to comment in terms of how I felt about it politically at the time, but certainly musically, I was just engrossed by it at the time, and I thought it was a great version.
Yeah, it is one of those songs that morphs and changes to fit the political climate of the day. And musically, I think it's worth mentioning too, just with this being the live version of it, that it would be a fun song that allows them to sort of flex, I guess, the song, or grow and shrink it as they need to, and you know, just Larry and Adam can keep the rhythm going for as long as they need to, for whatever rant Bono needs to insert. And Edge is just, it's just a, you know, a wide open low E string kind of rock song that he can just riff on for a while if he needs to, and things like that. So yeah, it's a fun one, and looking back on all the different versions of it, of course, it's kind of fun to hear one of the original live versions of it at the time. So
I think it's certainly the definitive live version. I mean, this has been released a number of times live on various B-sides, and obviously we've got live fan club albums or whatever, but I think this is the definitive live version.
Oh, I don't know about that, Aaron. I'd debate that with you, but I'm just kidding.
It's the version that had the least amount of visuals to support the message that the song was trying to convey. So yeah, for me, Rattle and Hum, it's the purest version of this song. It's just about the music. Once you break it into the Zoo TV tour, and I think my dog agrees with me, once you break it into the Zoo TV tour with the visuals, and then as the song is morphed over time, it is linked to the visuals more than it is to the music.
Mm. Yeah, that could be true for certain. I know for me it was the B-side to Stay, which is a weird comparing, but during the Zoo TV tour, Zoo Europa, I guess, tour, that really sort of stuck with me. But again, that's sort of being my era for U2 or whatever, is kind of when I locked in with them. And but no, I think each time when they sort of reinvent the song slightly or change it up a little bit or whatever, I love it again even more. And it's not one, you know, comparing it to Pride that gets played a lot, obviously, live, that one stays more or less the same. They don't mess with it. They don't change the structure a bit. They don't, the style stays the same, all that kind of stuff. Other than, like we said, maybe changing the key and tempo.
You just ramp up the anger portion of
it. Exactly. But visually, it's definitely been one they've had a lot more fun with too. So, all right, we're almost at the end. The credits are rolling on the film, and we get to hear All I Want Is You.
This is the song that, you know, it closes out the album, it closes out the movie, and it's the one that when I was collecting my illegal recordings, that I enjoyed the most when I heard it live. And I think, Aaron, you could probably speak to it, because on the Lovetown tour, it was phenomenal.
Absolutely.
So it's just one of those songs where you just want to be in it. I think Matt has mentioned about being in a dark room with headphones on and just getting lost within it. And every time I want to get lost in a song, I will always pick All I Want Is You.
Yeah. I mean, they collaborated really well on this one as well, because they used Van Dyke Parks on this one. And, you know, The album version is brilliant. I never liked the single because they edited it down too much. They took about 2-3 minutes out of it. But it's a lovely end to this album. And I have to say, All I Want Is You, in my honest opinion, is the most underrated U2 song they've yet recorded. It's also probably the most underrated live song they perform. And that's how I feel about this song. And the video for it as well, for the single, because it was quite a late single in terms of U2 post-album release, because it was released a good 9-10 months after the album had come out. But they made a real big effort in creating a fantastic video, which was actually a 15-minute concept story with the circus performers and whatever. And I say it's one of the great love songs, not just by U2, but by any musical act. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, I think, and you mentioned the live version too, where it is one of those ones that they've kind of refined over time in the live version and playing. I think it was the Vertigo tour. It's definitely on the U2 22 live CD, I think, or whatever. That version is just great, because Edge gets to just sort of scream on it as well, and his guitar solo and stuff, and take the what is a simple riff or chords, again, which can be easily played on an acoustic, just, you know, by yourself, solo guitarist or whatever, singer, to like full band rocking a, you know, 50,000 seat stadium or whatever, which I think is a testament to it being a great song, that it works both places just as well, with different music and stuff like that. So, and a great song to close out the album.
It's just beautiful, isn't it? It's great. It's just absolutely fantastic. And also it's got a great video that goes along with it as well. So,
one thing I want to say about Rattlin' Home before we finish tonight is, whoever's may or may not be listening to this in YouTube world, whether it's the band themselves or whether it's the management, the record company, please, please, please get this album released as a 30th anniversary album, whatever. 2018's coming up. Take your time and release it. It deserves to be re-released and have the full deluxe package. We want it.
Yeah, it wasn't, it has never been remastered, right? Or was it?
That's right. It's, yeah. They skipped it. I think they may have had problems with trying to get the album and the DVD.
Well, the DVD, whatever. The DVD is now out of print.
That's right.
The rights are no longer under Paramount Pictures. They've reverted back to the band. So the band have control over what they want to do and how they want to do it. So I have to agree with you, Aaron. We need a commemorative version of this.
Yeah. And we know there's 6 hours of outtakes.
Yeah.
I mean, I just happen to have a copy along with the million other people on grainy old VHS. But
yeah, 7 VHSs. Nothing beats Bono's trip to the hospital, let me tell you.
That's right. And they ask him his name. Remember that bit? Right, what's my name?
Just give me the bloody pain medication, why don't you?
All right, well, there's something to send you Googling if you don't already know what they're talking about. I've kind of vaguely remember hearing myths and rumors of extra footage that's been out there in the world. So with the internet being the internet, I'm sure there's ways and places to find it that we will not discuss on this podcast. But
and they will not be in the show notes, but no. You can Google it.
Yeah. Which is why you two, whoever's out there, should release it, because fans are watching it in crummy little video versions or whatever on their computers, and they deserve to see that in full HD or whatever it is capable, I guess, from the footage you have. Anyways, all right, let's wrap this episode up before we start going into, before folks, what was the way Bonham put it, to get sick of us and the red light has come on. It's time for us to go away and dream it all up again and be back for another episode of the podcast, so you're not completely sick of us. Aaron, where can folks find you on the internet if they disagree with your assessment of Bolt of Blue Sky being the definitive version?
You can find me on Twitter at Ivanobe, Ivanobe, or contact me via the contact list on www.atu2.com.
Yeah, a good little website to check out. Kenny, how about you?
You can find me on Twitter at SingNoMore, or you can come and find me on the At U2 forum.
All right, and Sherry?
You can always find me at U2ComSherry on Twitter.
Awesome, and I'm iChris on Twitter, and of course, like we have said, you can follow the At U2 site, all news and stuff that we tweet out at ATU2 on Twitter. If there happens to be a concert by U2 in 2016, that's where you're. Sherry or somebody will be live tweeting it, I'm sure. And facebook.com/ATU2com is where you can like us and keep up with information on there. And then goodstuff.fm/ATU2 is where you can find all the episodes of this podcast. Find the link to subscribe in iTunes if you do that. We haven't asked for it in a while, actually, but if you feel so inclined, leaving a rating and or review in iTunes is an awesome way to let folks know about the podcast. It's kind of how Apple and iTunes rate or find popular podcasts. So you can leave us a rating or review, and that'd be awesome and help the word get out about the podcast. For now, thanks for listening. We'll see you again next time. Bye.